Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Welcome to the Punk Rock MBA podcast.
What's up, everybody? I'm Finn McKenty. This is the Punk Rock MBA podcast. Today's guest is one that a lot of people have asked for, Spencer from Ice Nine Kills. Now, these guys have a very interesting story. For anyone who's not familiar with the band, they're, I would say, one of the more popular metalcore bands these days, but they actually started way back in, I think he said 2002, as a ska band. That's right. Checkers, suspenders, the whole nine yards. And although they're doing really well now, it took a long fucking time to get here. Like we discussed in the podcast, it took them a good, you know, maybe 12 or 13 years to get any kind of real traction at the national level, and they didn't really blow up until 2018 with their most recent album. So I want to sit down with him and unpack exactly how that happened, because how rare is it to see a band have that kind of an inflection point that late in their career? So I wanted to hear from him, what exactly did they do that made the band take off? How did they come up with those ideas? And also, what kept him going during the years where they weren't getting the traction that they wanted? During those years, you know, back in the mid-2000s when they were doing okay, but certainly not like they were now. I don't know that I would have had the mental strength or confidence to keep going, but he did, and the results speak for themselves. So we get into all that and more in the episode. Really cool conversation. Before I get into the episode, wanted to remind you that if you're interested, there are three ways that you can support the show. Number one, the easiest thing you can do, and actually probably the most helpful, is to share the show on social media, because that helps us grow. As you know, the podcast platforms like Spotify and Apple Music don't do a great job of promoting shows. So that's where you guys and girls out there are very helpful. If you want to share it on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram or TikTok or Vine, if you somehow still have a Vine account, even though it doesn't exist anymore, make a Vine about it. I don't care. If you want to share it on social media, tag me, tag the guest, and tag Deanna. We would appreciate it very much. Number two, if you like us even more than that, you can buy some merch. There's a link to that in the show notes. And finally, if you really, really, really like us, you can support us on Patreon. There's a link to that in the show notes as well. Patrons get access to every show a week early. There's an opportunity for me to review your band or YouTube channel or podcast or graphic design portfolio or any other thing that you want to send my way. So if that sounds interesting, there's a link to the Patreon in the show notes. And with that out of the way, let's get into it.
Spencer, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me, man. I've been watching your YouTube videos for quite some time, so it's good to finally get to talk to you.
Well, I'm flattered that you watch, and I hope I never said anything bad about you.
Not that I have heard, but I'll be reviewing some of the videos after this to make sure.
Yeah, we'll watch the tape, and there will be consequences. I just finished watching, I haven't quite finished Ozark. I'm on the last episode of season three of Ozark, and I don't know if you've seen the show, but I was just thinking of the lawyer, Helen. She says, "If anybody tells my daughter, there will be consequences."
Exactly. I finished that a couple nights ago, and I was so impressed with the third season that now I'm going back around. I finished season one again, and now I'm in the middle of season two.
God,
so it's just a fantastic show.
It's so good. Like, I never watch TV in that show. I definitely never, like, binge watch anything. But when that show comes out, it's like, okay, everything else stops. The other show that I'm addicted to is Homeland, and both of those give me horrible anxiety.
I have not seen Homeland, but I know some people in my family that are absolutely obsessed with that show. So maybe I should give it a try. But I am like you in the sense that I'm not the guy that's always up on which new show to watch. And in fact, when I hear a lot of people talking about a certain show, it kind of makes me not want to check it out because I just am bombarded with, oh, you got to check this out. You got to check.
So you haven't seen Tiger King. That's the name of it, right?
I did give in to that one, and I am happy about that.
Really? All right. Well, maybe I'll try it then. Anytime, especially with Netflix, if I see a bunch of Facebook hype about something Netflix related, that usually means I won't like it. But maybe in this case, I'm wrong.
I am usually like this, but this is just comedy. You know, it's obviously a real life, chronicling real life events, but it's like sort of a car crash in the sense that you don't want to look, but you can't look away from the atrocity.
Well, what I wanted to talk about, I'll just tell you my perception of the story that I have in my head about the band, and you can tell me what part of this is right or wrong, and maybe fill in the story. So Ice Nine Kills started, like, I guess 15 years ago or something like that. And I think you guys found your kind of musical direction quite a while ago, maybe, like, I don't know, which is the album that came out with, like, the gray face on the cover?
Predator Becomes the Prey.
Yeah. Yeah.
2013.
Yeah, I think that one was, like, where you guys kind of found your groove there, but didn't really pick up commercially to the level that you're at now until fairly recently. I mean, you guys did well, but, I mean, I just saw this dramatic uptick with the most recent album from, I guess it's actually 2 years old now or something. And it seems like, you know, you went through some lineup changes, but it seems like you kind of found the right people. And then a little bit later found the right kind of, you know, packaging for that. And then everything clicked.
It's a crazy story, man. And it's one that I think is a bit unusual, considering it took so long to really find our footing and get on the map, so to speak. And it took almost 20 years. I know the internet, like Wikipedia, lists us, I think, as the first album was 2006. And that was the first proper, like, release we put out with packaging and when we started to be a little bit more professional about things. But I actually started the band as a pop punk ska band in the summer of 2000.
A ska band? I saw that on Wikipedia. I was wondering if that was true.
It's 100% true. You know, I grew up worshiping bands like Goldfinger, Real Big Fish, Less Than Jake. All the Epitaph record scene, Blink, obviously. And we were a pop punk ska band for pretty much all the way through high school. So like 2000 to 2004, we eventually just started to adapt more influences. You know, I always liked heavy music, but I'm a pop punk ska kid at heart.
You're wearing a drive-through hoodie right now.
I am wearing a drive-through hoodie. That was probably the seminal label for me. That, you know, back in the day when I started the band, the goal was we have to get signed. That was number one on the list. And you would research online, like, well, you know, how did you know, Mest get signed to Maverick? Well, you know, John Feldman took them under their wing. You know, how did Newfound Glory get signed? And I worshiped all those drive-through bands like Midtown and Finch and Senses Fail. And that was like the Cadillac of labels to me. And we, like bands back then, remember the days of physical press kits, mm-hmm. and putting together, you know, getting the big envelope at Staples and writing up a bio. And, you know, I had my uncle take a promo photo of us. And if I could dig that up, you'll have a good laugh about that as far as what we were wearing.
Were there checkers?
There were, definitely some some ska checkered. I think it was either a belt or suspenders or something.
Oh, checkers and suspenders.
Yeah.
Wow.
I think our original slogan was Ice Nine, music to make your nipples hard. So you could you can imagine this sort of the fandom we were into as far as, you know, the whole Blink kind of aesthetic. Yeah, we just kept pushing forward. And I think that very recently, you know, the album before The Silver Scream, Every Trick in the Book, that was the first album where I feel like I stopped caring about the trends. I stopped saying, hey, is this part heavy enough, or is this going to fit in with what's going on Rise? You know, how do we get signed here and blah, blah, blah. And I think that's when we really started to see a large response from people. I had always been into horror, and that sort of always permeated through everything we did as far as, you know, it might be a song lyric or a song title or a piece of merchandise, but we never doubled down on the horror thing. And I think I was at the point where I could tell that was the next move for us. I think something that's important is that the love for horror and the inclusion of it in our band and our aesthetic comes from a very authentic place, because I've been obsessed with that genre since I was 6 or 7 years old. And I think melding those two loves, you know, my love for music and horror, also with the sort of Broadway stuff that I like Les Miserables and Phantom, and sort of saying, you know, let's not follow the pack, let's run in the other direction. And that's when I think people started to really respond to it. And I know you talk about that a lot, about finding that thing that sets you apart. And I think that that's what we eventually landed on. It took about, 16, 17 years to do so.
The 16-year overnight success.
Exactly. But something really funny is I was cleaning out a storage locker about a year ago where I kept all my memorabilia or collections from the band over the time, like flyers and stuff from VFW shows. And I found this rejection letter from a label that said, hey, thanks for sending this. We're not really interested now, but, keep your head up and keep creating. And that was from Fearless Records. And that was, 2003. And we ended up signing with them, almost 10 years later.
Oh, so wow.
I thought that was a cool thing to find. And I sent a picture it over to the guy who founded the label, Bob Becker. And he had a good kick out of that. Got a good kick out of it.
Well, there's a lot of things there that I want to unpack. But one of them would be, you made the point that this is coming from an authentic place and that the moment where you stopped caring or stopped kind of trying to go with the trends is when it clicked. A lot of people, I think, from the outside would say the opposite, like, oh, this is when Spencer decided he was, going to give up his integrity and just go all in on this corny image thing.
Right. And the thing that works so well with using horror is that it's inherently cheesy. Those slasher movies that I grew up loving, especially the ones that sort of came in the wake of Halloween, like Friday the 13th and Silent Night, Deadly Night, all of those sort of admittedly schlocky, sleazy kind of movies are inherently cheesy and campy. And it always sort of gives me a good chuckle when I see someone with a negative comment like, oh, those guys are so cheesy. Like, yeah. No shit. I mean, that's sort of that is sort of the point. And if you're saying that, you're never going to get it.
I mean, especially with stuff like Friday the 13th, those were so tongue in cheek. I'm not a big horror guy, but I mean, even I can pick up on that.
Absolutely. And for me, even the movies that have very low production value, it's almost like punk rock bands that you kind of miss that sort of organic sounding recording or, stuff that doesn't have that super major label sheen. And that's the way I sort of look at some of those older movies. There's something charming in a out of focus shot or an awkward performance that I think kind of translates to maybe why I like some of those punk bands that, didn't have, weren't playing to a click track or something like that.
I don't want to get us sidetracked here, but I'm going to get us sidetracked for a moment. There's a whole sort of area of horror that I remember from when I was maybe, in eighth or ninth grade. All these like direct to VHS series, like Witchmaster, stuff like that, where, there's another one. Well, they're all about somebody inadvertently summoning this like wisecracking demon that, will grant you a wish, but no matter what you say, it's going to backfire in some like sort of way that a 14-year-old would think is really cool.
Wishmaster. I remember that series.
Wishmaster, yeah. Well, but it's not just that. There's like a whole, there's like 10 different series like that. But I'm really nostalgic for that kind of specific subset of horror, that like late 80s, early 90s, direct to VHS kind of era of horror. And I don't like horror at all, but that particular era definitely does something for me.
I do remember seeing those VHS covers and usually good looking girls on the front of those VHSs that you're describing. It was a good way to attract the young clientele such as yourself at the time, I'm sure.
I vividly remember looking at all those. I've never seen probably 90% of them, but I can remember the covers of the VHSs like crystal clear.
Absolutely, man.
What's the one with the girl with the knife behind her back?
That would be, I think, April Fool's
Day. Yes.
Yes.
I've never seen that movie.
I actually watched it last night just because they're celebrating April Fool's.
And her hair is like a noose?
Yes, I was just about to say that. I'd never seen that before. If I was a girl, that's definitely how I would wear my long hair. I think
all of that being said, like the joking aside, there's so much imagery to pull from. I mean, the fact that I remember that VHS cover from when I was a kid decades ago, like really says how much there is for you to pull from.
100%. And the fact that you mentioned that the covers and the VHS art, that's what initially attracted me, like so many other people, I'm sure, to the genre. I would go to the supermarket with my mom, and within the supermarket, there was a VHS store, and I would go in there to kill time. And for whatever reason, I was drawn to the aisle that said horror. And I would just sort of fixate on these covers of Friday the 13th and covers like what you were referring to, like April Fool's Day. And there was just something so enthralling about that imagery that I convinced my parents to let me see those films. It took some persistence, but I eventually got my wish. And it was funny because my parents always thought, oh, he'll grow out of it. And, you know, here we are 30 years later, yeah, talking about my love of the genre.
So tell me about the process of The Silver Scream, which I think we would agree is kind of your magnum opus so far. When did you decide to really go all in? Like, every song is about a different movie, right?
Absolutely, yeah. So the seed was really planted the album before, which was called Every Trick in the Book. And the way that I arrived on that concept for that record, which is all about novels as opposed to movies, is we were told that in between two album cycles, we should do a bridge track, you know, a track between two albums. And we were working on this song. And the way that I generally do vocals is, you know, I don't think of the actual lyrics right away. I put sort of stream of consciousness down just to get the rhythmic patterns and the melodies that I like, and then go back and put the actual lyrics to it. And for whatever reason, when we were doing this particular song that preceded Every Trick in the Book, the way that I was doing vocals, it sounded like there were two personalities at play. And I was thinking, you know, wouldn't it be kind of cool if we did a song about Jekyll and Hyde, about that book? Because I can hear these two characters like fighting, and thought it would be interesting to write that way. So we did that song. It became Me, Myself, and Hyde, and it got a great reaction. And I think that was also the turning point where I decided we're going to be weird. You know, we're a heavy band, but we're going to open with a minute that sounds like it's from the opening of Phantom of the Opera. And that did really well. And I thought, let's do the whole album. We're going to include Me, Myself, and Hyde on this next album. Let's continue the theme. Let's do every song about a different book. And it seemed to work well. And I kept hearing from people that were really into the band, oh man, you know, what would it be like if you guys did horror? And like, what would it sound like if Ice Nine Kills did Friday the 13th or Halloween or Nightmare on Elm Street? And I was already thinking that as well. So I thought, this just seems like the logical next step. And as far as creating the album, what I did was I got the old whiteboard out, and I wrote down every single movie that I thought would make a compelling song. So I had a list in the studio of, like, I want to say 50 to 75 titles. And I knew that I wanted to A, cover sort of the godfathers of what I consider the slasher genre. You know, you can't do an album about slasher and horror and not include Michael, Jason, Freddy, sure, Leatherface. So I knew I wanted to do those. B, I knew that I didn't want to do too many stories that were too similar. You know, obviously there are parallels between Michael and Jason, but that's why I said, you know, let's do the Halloween song from the perspective of Michael, but let's do the Jason song from the perspective of the counselors at the camp. So I wanted to definitely keep some variety in the storytelling. And C, I wanted to not just do the horror movies that everyone knows when they think of that. I want to introduce our audience to some more obscure ones that had success on a cult level, but weren't the, you know, Pepsi Cola, Coca-Cola brand names like Michael Myers and Jason. So I did songs like Silent Night, Deadly Night, about, you know, a film that was a smaller success, but, you know, has a lot of great material to pull from. And then I sort of whittled it down, and you know, a lot of stuff got left on the cutting room floor, pun intended. I think we arrived at 13 movies that I was really happy with.
What's an obscure movie that you wish you could have fit on there but couldn't?
I know that there was a movie called The Burning that I really wanted to cover that was released right in the wake of Friday the 13th. It's funny because the makeup special effects guru who has become this really famous guy named Tom Savini, oh, who, yeah, created, yeah, the look of Jason in the first one, actually turned down Friday the 13th Part 2 to work on The Burning. So, that speaks volumes about what he thought about the project. And it's just a really cool, underrated film. And there are 20 like that that I would have liked to cover.
Sure.
But that one is coming to mind.
Was there ever a moment during this creative process where you doubted yourself, or were you 100% confident the whole time, or how are you thinking about that?
We were at a point where we had been doing it for so long. As you said, we had some minor success and we were starting to be able to sustain ourselves financially. Not, by any means were we wildly successful, but it started to pick up, the Warped Tour that we had done before. We could see that something was happening there, but I felt like this was really the make or break moment. And I sort of used that as part of my motivating factor. We're going to make this happen right now with this album. And I was really confident throughout the whole process, but no way did I think it was going to click as well as it did. I didn't know that this was going to be the thing that put us on the map, but all I knew is that I was having the most fun I've ever had when creating an album. And I think that subconsciously, came through in the writing of it, because when you're enjoying something, kids can see that. Mm-hmm. Kids can feel that, the authenticity. And that sort of goes back to my other point. It's got to be something that sets you apart from the pack, but something that you believe in. And as sort of Kevin Costner speech as that sounds at the end of a Kevin Costner movie, it's something that I actually do believe.
In hindsight, it seems predictable to me that this worked, but of course in the moment you never really know. In hindsight though, I feel like there's so much crossover between heavy music and horror that of course it worked, but I feel like there's also an element of timing that the sort of cross-pollination of horror culture with heavy music has kind of hit a level that wasn't there before that made this really the right time to do it, versus if you did this in 2007, I don't think it would have worked as well.
I agree. I think that the timing was lightning in the bottle, in the sense that, yes, horror has definitely always been popular, but it definitely rides waves. The 80s saw a huge boom, mm-hmm. with the slasher craze. It died out because the genre became just so watered down and oversaturated. And then back up in the 90s with Scream, that sort of, yep. set the whole genre ablaze. And yeah, that Scream to me is much like Halloween. It set a precedent and then all these imitators followed. Then it died down and then back up with Hostel and back up with the whole torture porn stuff. And in the last few years, you're right, we're seeing a huge resurgence with the commercial and critical success of movies like It, of movies like Get Out, the new Halloween coming out and being such a huge success. And it was time just with the album. And in some respects, I did know wow, we're doing a song about Halloween. I know in a year and a half, that new Halloween's coming out. Mm-hmm. We've got to release it around then. And I knew that It Chapter 2 was coming out, so let's release the video around then. All that stuff is very premeditated. But I think that we struck some luck there that we happened to release this album right when we're seeing a huge renaissance of the genre.
And also, if you look at what Hot Topic is now, which, you can laugh at a Hot Topic if you want, but I think it's a pretty good kind of indicator of the, where the mainstream commercial side of the genre is. Hot Topic is a geek culture store now more than anything else. What do they call those, Funko figures and horror stuff and Green Lantern shirts and stuff now? I mean, that's in a way horror and geek culture is the new alternative.
Absolutely. And it's right there in the name of the store, Hot Topic. They've got their finger on the pulse of what's going on in the culture. And you brought up sort of that fandom lifestyle, and that too I feel like is bigger than ever. We're seeing at our shows families coming to Ice Nine Kills concerts, all dressed as the characters from these movies. And it's yeah, and we're seeing it, this family will come and there'll be a 3 or 4 year old kid dressed up like Jason, and we think, oh, you know, that's cute. They're kind of using their kid as an accessory. And then you'd have that kid on his father's shoulder singing the words to these songs. So there's that Comic-Con kind of lifestyle mm-hmm. culture that is sort of family oriented. And I think that's also part of those worlds colliding at the right time.
That's a really good point, that there is a community aspect to horror that's not really there with other genres. I mean, horror is never, at least not since like the 80s, has never been the most commercially successful genre, but it's always there. And there's always that, it's kind of like metal, that there's always that diehard community of people who just absolutely love it and their whole lifestyle revolves around it. And there's a community there in a way that's not true of, you know, the Fast and the Furious is commercially super successful, but like, I don't know that there's anybody like dressing up like characters from the Fast and the Furious other than me.
Other than you, yeah. It's true. It's like that, you know, it's that nerd culture. And that's what I am. You know, I'm the guy that not only watches the obscure movies, but I watch the documentaries about the obscure movies. And I want to know every detail about the mask and where this was filmed and what kind of knife they used. And I think that obsessive sort of draw to our band is right in line with those kind of films. So it's like a perfect storm, so to speak.
Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com.
This is Krista Makes, guitarist and vocalist for Less Than Jake, and host of Krista Makes a Podcast, a songwriting podcast where every week I'm joined by an amazing guest to break down the writing, recording, and release of one iconic song from their career. In our giant evergreen back catalog of episodes, we've had rock legends such as Dee Snider and Huey Lewis, punk rock favorites like Mark Hoppus, Fat Mike, and Brett Gurewitz, and up-and-coming artists of today such as Liz Stokes of The Beths and Genesis Owusu. We've had guests from all genres and styles of music, and I guarantee that if you peruse our back catalog, you'll see several episodes that'll make you say, man, I gotta hear that. Whether you're a fan of music or a creator of music yourself, you'll take away a whole new appreciation for the songs you know and love. Krista Makes a Podcast is available for free on all the places you could possibly listen to podcasts, and new episodes come out every Monday.
But first, I want to thank DistroKid for sponsoring this episode of the podcast. If you're not familiar, DistroKid is a digital music distribution service that musicians use to put their music into online stores and streaming services. So in plain language, if you have ever wondered how to get your music on iTunes, Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube Music, Amazon, Deezer, Tidal, and many, many more, there's like dozens and dozens of different streaming services, DistroKid is the way to do it. It is super easy. I have used it to put my music on Spotify. It took me maybe 5 minutes to like set it up and upload everything. It's legitimately awesome. I am sincerely a fan of this company and their product. And for those of you who have asked, you can also upload your music to TikTok with DistroKid. And if you want a chance to get featured on DistroKid's Spotify playlists, you can do that by submitting a song through Spotlight and getting your fans to vote for you. You can also use Hyperfollow to get more Spotify followers. You can promote your new release as well as Spotify Canvas. That's where there's the video in the background in the player. And when you share it on Instagram, it shares that video too to make your Spotify release pop. And Spotify Canvas is available to all DistroKid artists. Like I said, as you can probably tell from this, like, I am sincerely a fan of DistroKid. DistroKid can do everything I just talked about and so much more. So be sure to sign up with my link, which is in the show notes for this episode, to get 7% off your first year. That link is in the show notes of this episode, or go to distrokid.com/VIP/thepunkrockNBA. And thanks again to DistroKid for sponsoring this episode.
So aside from the creative direction, I think another part of this, again, from the outside, that seems to me to be very important is getting the right people together. So JD joined the band in, what, 2010 or something like that? maybe a little earlier?
About that time, 2009-ish, 2010.
I don't know him, but my business partner, Al Levy, who hates everybody and is super critical of everyone, says that JD's brilliant. So if Al likes him, then that goes a long way in my book as far as his musical ability. And I saw that you guys worked with Drew Falk on the Silver Scream, who is a fucking genius. So can you talk about like bringing the right people together and what role that plays?
I think so. You know, when you're a band, you're only as good as the team that you have. And that carries over to not just the music, but, you know, to the business side of things. You need the right lawyer, you need the right manager, the right label, the right producer. It takes a while to find the right people. I know that when we were doing this album, we met with a number of different producers. Drew just got it. You know, he's a visual guy. He loved the storytelling element of what we were doing. And I think that if you have the right synergy with people, it goes such a long way. Another crucial element to the team is this guy, Steve Sopchak, who's been a producer of ours for a long time and co-writes a lot of the lyrics with me. Yeah, it's about finding people that complement each other's skill sets and acknowledging where you might lack in some areas and where someone might excel in others. For me, for instance, I'm not a guy that's seeking out a ton of new music. I'm not the guy that's on like the cusp of what's happening. And I don't really like it to influence my writing. But I accept that it's good to have someone on the team that does have that and can bring that element to the table. So I think it's finding the real checks and balances and a well-rounded team. And I think that that's what we arrived on.
How do you know when you've found a good partner?
Huh, that's a broad one. I like that. For me, it comes down to getting in the room and working with a person. You know, you could set up a business meeting to try and see, you know, do we have the same influences? What are our goals in terms of songwriting? What bands do we think that are doing it right? Where do we see ourselves? But until you get out with them on the field, you're never going to know. It's like it's like the old saying. It's like you don't know someone until you live with them. You know, they say that you probably shouldn't marry a girl unless you spend significant time living with that person because you don't know.
Definitely advise against marrying someone you have not lived with. That is true. That would be a very bad idea.
And this whole situation with this pandemic is quite an incubator for that. So I think we're going to see a lot of relationships probably ruined.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah, we'll see. Hopefully not worse. I worry about wives and husbands in the same area for too long, but hopefully everyone will get past that.
So far, so good on our end.
Yeah, me too. Although I haven't heard from my girlfriend for a few days. Hope she's all right. I think like with anything, whether it's hiring a new social media guy or a new artist, you could talk until you're, you know, blue in the face, but until we get there in the room and see what everyone brings to the table, you're not going to know.
Well, I'll ask this question. I hope it's not too direct, and I don't mean it to sound rude, but I'm just genuinely curious. You've had a lot of lineup changes. You know, I love looking at those Wikipedia like charts with all the different, you know, members over the years and stuff. And
yeah,
usually when I see a chart that looks like the Ice Nine Kill Zone, where there's one member that's been there the whole time and a bunch of other people, I go, okay, that person's a dick and nobody likes working with him. You don't seem to be that person. So why have you had so many lineup changes? Or are you actually an asshole and you're just good at hiding it?
I'm just a huge asshole. But other than that, it really comes down to, I think, a few things. You know, we've been a band for so long. A lot of those members that you see on Wikipedia, I knew when I was 14 or 15. So you think about a high school band and how many lineup changes they go through. So I don't really think of the band starting as far as a sophisticated level until 2006-ish. But it's funny because most of those members from high school are like, still some of my best friends, you know, guys, I'm, you know, you're part of the bachelor party, the groomsmen lot of their weddings and stuff. And the guy that I actually formed the band with and knew since I was in seventh or eighth grade, who left the band in 2008-ish. And he was the guy that was always my writing partner, sort of the ride or die guy. He actually came back in the fold on this last album. And we co-wrote a couple of the songs. His name's Jeremy Schwartz. And he's just a terrific collaborator, and it was cool to get someone from the OG lineup back in. But I think as far as the lineup changes in general, I think people's tastes change. People want different things out of the business. I've always been the leader of the band as far as from every angle, really, as far as from marketing and from songwriting and from vision. You know, not everyone agrees with every single creative choice I've ever made. So I think it's it just comes down to finding the right people. And this lineup in particular right now is just clicking so well. And I think it's the strongest the band has ever been. And I'm really excited about the dynamic personally with this new lineup.
So, like, what advice would you have for somebody who is, I think, kind of the person that sounds like you've been forever, where you know that this is what you want to do, you're 100% all in, and there's somebody in the band, because I get this question a lot, there's somebody in the band that either isn't as serious or has different, you know, different creative vision or whatever, and they're trying to persuade this person to be on the same page as they are, and they're wondering, should I kick this person out? Can I persuade them? I mean, this is such a common situation. You've been through it before. What would you say?
I think that from my experience in doing the band, just like we discussed with so many lineup changes and stuff, I honestly believe that the best way to handle a band is that let's figure out whose vision this is. You know, who is there day and night working on the band, who is putting in the most time and effort. And I believe that there should be a single leader in the band. I think there's, you know, there is a place and there are bands where it's like more of a democracy in the sense like everyone gets to vote. But the old adage of too many cooks in the kitchen, I think, is an adage for a reason. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, I'd rather have a band that's successful where a few people were upset initially about a certain idea than, you know, everyone get their stamp on something, but it maybe not turns out quite as cohesive. So I think that it's a difficult and it's a loaded question because I don't know the intricacies, obviously, of every band's dynamic and who started the band and who owns the band name and stuff like that as far as legalities. I would say that it is better to have one person's vision. At least that's in my experience, but I'm sure it could be accomplished as more of a democracy. I haven't seen it work.
Well, that's kind of where I was headed with it is, I think when you're younger, or at least when I was younger, I thought you could sort of persuade people to come around. And I don't think that's generally true. Like maybe I could persuade you to like this particular chorus or something, but on big things, like do we want to be a horror themed band or not? If we're just fundamentally on different pages about that, I think it's very rare for people to ever bridge a gap that big. And it's probably, in most cases, better to just part ways. Doesn't have to be any hard feelings. It's just like, you want pizza and I want fine dining.
I agree. I think if it's like a fundamental disagreement, you know, something black and white, I think probably the best advice would be, hey, you guys start two different bands and let's see what happens.
Yeah.
On the smaller levels, you know, if we're talking about, hey, do we want to play Long Island or do we want to play in the city on that weekend?
Right, right,
you know,
right.
I think there is a way to get on the same page with that stuff. But another thing I'll bring out on that topic is that's when I think a manager can be very helpful. When you get into a place where you've hired management or you hire a lawyer or a label, you know, you're paying those people a percentage of your earnings. And, you know, if you don't listen to their advice most of the time, it's like, why are you paying these people? And I found our team to be very good mediators in terms of disagreements or, you know, differences of opinion. And also sometimes, you know, when the band was more of a joint effort as far as creative and collaborative decision-making in the studio, you know, years back, I often, you know, said, you know, let's find the producer whose opinion that we trust. And if we both think two different things about a take or about a chorus should be this way, a chorus should be that way, let the producer be the deciding vote and shake on that. Mm-hmm. It was a good technique to move past an issue. We both trust this person. In the event of a tie, he's going to be the deciding vote.
Tell me about what kept you going, let's say 2010, where there was some success, but I'm guessing you guys weren't making a ton of money back then. And that's the point where I've seen a lot of bands break up or a lot of people quit and go get a job. You know, they're like in their late 20s or something like that. And they're just like, you know what? We're doing okay, but we're not doing great. I'm out. And I understand why. But on the other hand, the fact that you stuck it out during that time is why you're here today. What kept you going then? Because if you're a smart guy, you're not like, you know, a loser that couldn't do something else with your life.
I think that there are a few different factors that, kept me going. I think one is just inherently who I am. I'm a bit stubborn. And, you know, my mom and dad used to tell me that all the time when I would be nagging them for, hey, you know, let me watch Friday the 13th. You know, let me get a paintball gun. Let me stay up late. Let me go sleep at my friend's house. They would call me relentless. They say, Spencer, you are relentless and you won't give up until you get your way. So I think inherently that's just who I am. And I wasn't going to let anyone tell me that I couldn't do what I wanted to, especially with my life. And there are two stories that I would sort of go back to when I would be feeling down about, hey, you know, why aren't we getting this tour? Why are we not attractive to this management company or this label? There's this always this true story in the back of my mind. One was about this band that could never get signed because they were too punk for the metal kids and too metal for the punk kids. But they kept going, and I think their manager ended up starting a label, and that band was Metallica. So for me, you know, thinking about, there was a time when no one believed in what would become arguably one of the biggest bands of all time. So that story always kept me going. Like, okay, well, maybe the people were telling me I'm not good and it's not going to work. They're not getting it right. They're wrong here. So that always kept me going. And then there was another story about a filmmaker that I really respect that was trying to get a film made. And, you know, he went to studio and different studios like Paramount. And I think it was Paramount Studios who told him, listen, no one's interested in films about dreams. So the guy took his script and he got the film made through a very small independent film studio at the time. And that movie went on to be A Nightmare on Elm Street. So you think about these stories about these people who believed in themselves, people, not only people on the street, but people in high up positions who have had, you know, an amazing amount of success in their respective business, told them that they weren't going to be able to do this. So those two stories always kept me going. And it was sort of that DIY punk rock mentality of, if you're not going to help me, I'm going to get out there on the streets and do it myself. And that led me to do things like, hey, we're not on the Warped Tour in 2008. We're going to get in the van and we're going to sneak into every single Warped Tour show and sell our CDs with our iPods. And that's what we did at every single date of the Vans Warped Tour in 2008. And, you know, I had a personal quota every day. I wouldn't stop until I sold 100 CDs myself.
Oh, shit. That's a lot.
Yeah. And, you know, you're walking around for 2 months.
So you sold 5,000 CDs then?
We sold 10,000 CDs that summer because we had four or five guys doing the same thing. I don't know if it was, not everyone's quota was 100, but everyone did very well.
I mean, that's no joke.
No, man. And that was, and still to this day, I hear things, or I hear people saying, hey, I remember getting a CD from you at Warped Tour, and that's how I heard about you. And that's how we used to book a lot of our tours back then. We would say, okay, well, shows are usually pretty bad, you know, Monday through Thursday. Let's book our own tours around the Taste of Chaos. And so the days that we weren't playing, we would be out in the lines. Each of us would have an iPod, back when people used iPods, a splitter and two sets of headphones so that each person could show two people at the same time. And, you know, that's how we got by on those early tours, hustling CDs and doing that kind of stuff. So to go back to your question, the stuff that kept me going are those heroes that I had that I knew sort of had to make their own way and carve their own paths, and just my own sort of relentless, never give up attitude.
Another thing that I think is important is you guys were, maybe the success wasn't coming as quickly as you would like, but there was consistent progression in terms of, like, I mean, you listen to your records and every one is noticeably better than the last one. So you were progressing musically and the band was growing. So it's not like it was like a flat line, like nothing happening.
Right. There was a period of time, and I can't actually talk about it too far in depth because of a contract that we had signed with this other label. But basically, there was a few year period where we were essentially, there was an anchor around our neck to a label that doesn't exist anymore, and there was nothing we could do to get off it. that took a lot of legal proceedings to finally get out and to be able to sign with a label and whatnot. So that was a very difficult time. But I think that we, you know, kept our heads down and kept writing and tried to get better every step of the way. And eventually, I think our musical abilities caught up to the vision that I had for the band.
And you can hear it even going back to the first one on Spotify is from 2007. And, you know, it's a little rough around the edges, but you can hear that the vision is there even going back to, you know, that far.
Thank you. Yeah, I think it's always cool to go back to those old recordings and see how much you have progressed, especially like, you know, vocally. I remember, you know, when I was getting really into Blink, you know, the first record I had from Blink was Dude Ranch probably. And just going back and like listening to Buddha and Cheshire Cat and being like, wow, man, like think about how far those guys came, and everyone sounded like shit when they started. So it's cool to see that. And I always like going back and hearing the earlier works from the bands that I love and seeing their journey, so to speak.
I mean, that's another great example. If you listen to Cheshire Cat or whatever, I wouldn't say it's great, but you can tell that the vision is there when you compare it to their later stuff where they were able to actually catch up to their creative vision.
100%. I think that, you know, A&R guys with the golden ears, you know, people say, oh, that's kind of a myth, but clearly it was there because, you know, the people that really were experts in as far as A&R and music industry, they could hear that potential in a band like Blink, even in an awkward performance, but like, oh, what is that? That bass line, there's something special about that. Or that lyric, or just the way these guys look, is a real talent to be able to see that, you know, the diamond in the rough, so to speak.
So another thing I wanted to ask you about is your clothing company. I don't know a ton about it other than what's on Instagram, but I'm interested. What can you tell me about that?
So Cleaver was started as basically another creative outlet for me, you know, stuff that might not necessarily work with the Ice Nine Kills aesthetic, although now with where the band is, they've kind of met in a perfect world. And it was just always something fun to do. Also just, you know, another source of income to be able to do the band full time. A few years back, without that, I don't think I would have been able to do it. And it's just me being really interested in the horror culture. I love going to those horror conventions. I love meeting the people in those movies, and Cleaver does a lot of those conventions, and it's just really a fun side project. And getting back to bands like Blink, that stuff always went hand in hand with those bands, you know, whether it was Atticus or Macbeth or Famous Stars and Straps. And I think it's just an extension of the culture that I grew up being interested in and always wanting to, you know, I want to look like that guy in that band. And you know, I was that guy. So it's fun to be on the other side of it and be able to create for our fans too.
How tied to the band is that brand? In other words, are there people who are into Cleaver that don't care about the band?
We're starting to see that there is definitely a percentage of Cleaver people that don't necessarily know about Ice Nine Kills, which is really kind of cool.
That's great.
And I think that's the idea, to continue to build that. We're going to be sort of relaunching the brand over the next few months with a sort of a new look and a new style, because what I really want to do is, like the band, I want to continue to do something different. You know, I don't want the brand to be too similar to mm-hmm. other brands. And I think that's honestly the way that you maintain longevity in both in the music world and I think in fashion. I think, you know, you can have a hot flash in the pan on either side. I think if you're creating something that strives to be a little different, you're setting yourself up for more time in being successful.
So there's a lot of people that want to start an apparel brand, or maybe they start an apparel brand with an Instagram account and three designs or something, and they realize how hard it is and it kind of just dies on the vine. What have you learned about running an apparel business? For how long have you been doing it now?
I guess technically since 2011, but it was very just much like, hey, you know, let's order some more shirts and put them up for the first like 5 or 6 years. But I would say since maybe 2016 is when we started to get serious and more sophisticated about the operation. And I think that I'm learning stuff every day. You know, we actually ran into quite a snafu a few days back. And again, just as a clothing brand owner, I'm constantly learning. We had contracted third parties to do a design, and one of the artists ended up just ripping off another artist, sort of. They didn't Xerox it, but it was clearly influenced by that design, and there was a whole sort of backlash on the internet saying, oh, you stole my design, and saying, you know, thinking that we did it maliciously.
Yeah, a lot of people don't understand that, is that, you know, you as the owner of the brand, you don't necessarily know where the artist got this skull from. And you trust that they won't copy somebody, because why would you do that? But it happens.
Absolutely. And by that same token, when you're the face of the brand, you do have to bear the responsibility for it. And I actually, you know, reached out to the guy, took down the art, offered to pay him, and said, you know, let's work together. We'd love to promote you. And he was just one of those kind of guys that was like, screw you, you know, you ripped me off, kind of a thing. But, you know, you can't really talk to those kind of people if they don't want to accept an apology. But yeah, it just gets back to the thing of always being willing to learn from your mistakes. It's just like the music business. But I do think there are so many advantages to starting a brand when you already have that infrastructure of something like a band, that built-in fan base. And it's proved to be very helpful to build up to where we are. And I'm excited to see it continue to grow. And we got some big plans for it.
Big things coming soon.
I hope so, yeah. And it's cool. You know, I grew up around the Salem area. And I think consciously and subconsciously, the whole obviously historical nature of that area seeped into who I am. And that's where the brand is still based. I love going to Salem during the October months, and we usually have a Cleaver / Ice Nine Kills 10 up on the streets of Salem during their big street fairs. And last year, a ton of Ice Nine Kills fans showed up, and we did a little like VIP meet and greet kind of thing, which was really cool. So it's really just a fun thing, and I love being involved in the October culture. So
stay spooky.
You gotta stay spooky.
Okay, well, last thing I wanted to ask you about, because I know you did the Texas Chainsaw Massacre-inspired song. That's one of the few horror movies that I actually really like, but specifically just for the cinematography, because Daniel Pearl, who is the director of photography on the original and the remake, is a genius. I love that one, but the one I really love is Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, which I never hear people talk about.
That's the one with Dennis Hopper.
Yes.
Which I think is great, too, and I think people, what they miss about that one is that it really is campy, and the first one is not. You know, the
right.
First one is a brutal horror film, and the second one, although it was directed by Tobe Hooper as well, It really leaned into the humor.
It's weird.
It's really weird. It's bizarre. I love Bill Moseley in that one. You know, Chop Top. He's always at those conventions we go to, and he's a really nice guy. I think it was underrated at the time, but I think it did find an audience, and it definitely is a cult film. And
okay.
I like that horror. You know, when horror comes out and it's not commercially successful, oftentimes, if it is good and it has some redeeming value, it will find its audience.
Okay. It's not totally embarrassing that I like that movie.
Absolutely not. And I would recommend, if you haven't seen Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Next Generation, I don't know if you've seen that one, but it features a pre-famous Matthew McConaughey, a pre-famous Renee Zellweger. And the funny story about that one is that it was made, it was shelved because everyone thought it was terrible. And then McConaughey and Zellweger exploded. I'm talking, you know, superstardom, Jerry Maguire level kind of stuff. Their agent, they had the same agent or the same manager. And those managers worked like hell to make sure that film never saw the light of day, because they thought it would, you know, ruin their career. At the same time, the studio that had is like, well, now we need to release this film because they're megastars. So that's another really sort of funny one that I think you might enjoy, because it's more in the vein of the second one.
So this is from like the early 90s or something?
It's, I think it came out in the mid 90s. Yeah, I think we came out it was made in the mid 90s, and it didn't surface for a few years because of that, all the hoopla that I was referring to. But The Next Generation, check that out.
I will. Cool. Well, thank you so much for your time. Anything else you want to plug or talk about or anything like that? Any words of wisdom before I let you go?
No, thanks a lot for having me on the show. As I said, I am a fan. So, I was watching your video saying, I wonder if he knows about us or is going to mention us. And when I saw you mention us on that, I think it was the Baby Metal video, I was like, ah, that's awesome.
Yes.
And I'm glad that you respected what we did, because you know, I definitely respect what you're doing, and I think you've got a great brand. I love the consistency.
Appreciate it.
So keep it up.
Thank you very much.
All right, my friends, that does it for this episode of the podcast. If you made it this far, thank you. Thank you for listening. We sincerely appreciate each and every one of you. If you want to help the show, there's a couple things that you can do. First of all, share it on social media. If you share it, tag us, tag Finn McKenty, that's me, and tag Deanna Chapman, that's a producer. Second thing you can do, if you really, really, really love us and really want to support us, you can support us on Patreon. There's a link to that in the show notes. You can leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you're listening to this, or you can do none of that. And you can just sit at home thinking about how awesome this podcast is. That works too. Again, thank you very much to each and every one of you for listening. We sincerely appreciate it, and we'll see you next time.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law.
See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Bowie, Dylan, Marley. You've heard the names and maybe you've heard their songs. But what about the stories behind the records that made titans of music like these so universally loved and important? Join me, Josh Adam Myers, host of The 500, as each week I go through a different album from Rolling Stone Magazine's 500 Greatest Albums list from 2012 with an incredible lineup of comedians, actors, and musicians talking about how the music has impacted their lives. New episodes of The 500 come out every Wednesday. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.